The Holocaust is the term used to spread the belief that 6 million Jews were murdered by the Germans during World War II, primarily by gassing in makeshift gas chambers deceptively disguised as shower rooms. This narrative is often repeated in Hollywood, by the media, and in the public school systems. However, a growing movement of brave scientists, historians, engineers, journalists, and other free speech activists have investigated the official politically correct Holocaust story and found it to be exaggerated and even false. These brave people are today called revisionists, but are often denounced as Holocaust deniers by the media. This labeling technique is used to discourage discourse and discussion about this controversial subject. These revisionists do not dispute that Jews were persecuted, deprived of civil rights, deported, interned, and forced to work at concentration camps, or that Jews died in those camps and ghettos during the war when diseases became a major problem. Neither do they dispute that criminal communist partisans, which a majority of were Jews, were also killed by shooting and hanging during the war. The revisionists do not deny these Jews and other victims of the war their dignity. They do not deny the victims to be remembered, and they do not deny to show compassion for any of the victims. No matter how they died, each and every one of these deaths was a tragedy, as were the deaths of millions of others during this horrific war. Millions of people, mostly Europeans, suffered and died horrible deaths on battlefields, on the high seas, and in firebombed cities during a conflict that most certainly would never have happened had international jury not declared war on Germany in 1933. The evidence that the revisionists use against the official Holocaust narrative are numerous. We will now go through some of the most convincing of them. During World War II, enemies were interned in concentration camps to avoid attempts at subversion against the nation. As an example, after the attack on Pearl Harbor, over 100,000 Japanese people who lived on the Pacific coast were interned by Democrat President Roosevelt with no crime other than being born Japanese. Executive Order 9066, signed by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, was issued on a premise that anyone of Japanese, German, and Italian descent could not be trusted and was to be treated as an enemy. They were viewed not as individual people, but as a menace to be dealt with harshly. Thus, thousands of Americans of Japanese, Italian, and German ethnicity were forcibly relocated and thrown into American concentration camps. Some were even forced to abandon their own homes and businesses. By rail car, they were shipped off to the concentration camps over 1,000 miles away. They were placed inside barbed wire fences with machine guns pointed down at them from watchtowers. They slept inside bug-infested barracks, and they were denied adequate medicines, shelter, and supplies.
You know, we had this chain link fence all around the camp, and we lived maybe a quarter of a block away from the fence, and the fence was guarded by soldiers. They walked back and forth with their guns on their shoulders. I went up to the fence and I heard a rustling in the grass. I really was kind of wistful for what was outside the fence and thinking, you know, I used to be able to do that.
Relocation centers are not normal and probably never can be. Home life is disrupted.
Roosevelt wartime law restricted the freedoms and required identity cards for these prisoners. None of these inmates were ever compensated for the loss of property or the time they spent in concentration camps. No war reparations were paid to them, and no movies were dedicated to them. American World War II posters and other propaganda materials centered on race, which turned the war into a race war. They pounded it into the public's head that the Japanese and Germans were less than human, subhuman, even akin to rats. These caused numerous atrocities against civilians during the war, as the American soldier was taught that these people were not even human.
All of the camps they built were in isolated spots.
10 of them scattered throughout the American West and a couple in Arkansas.
Heart Mountain, Poston, and Tule Lake were the largest. Tule Lake also housed those whose loyalty the government specifically questioned. The War Relocation Authority, or WRA, called them relocation centers.
I remember when they would say, well, you're being interned for your own protection. Well, as a 10, 11-year-old kid, I knew that if I were in here for my own protection, why are the machine guns pointing in at us and not out?
We heard this young man shouting and saying, as I recall, something about they couldn't keep him there, that he was an American. And he started walking out, and the guard, who was probably about 15 feet from him, just shot him in the stomach.
Concentration camps were in fact not unusual at the time. Finland and even neutral Sweden also interned communists in concentration camps, since communists could not be trusted. It was actually the British Jewish financiers who invented the concentration camps in Boer in October of 1899, when they looked for gold and diamond in South Africa. In 1933, when international Jewry had declared war upon Germany, they formally established themselves as an enemy of Germany, which according to international law, gave Germany the legal right to disarm and intern the German Jews. After the repeated attempts of subversion, murders, and a terror against the German people, the Jews had made themselves into enemies of the German nation. The National Socialists logically considered Jews as a direct threat to national security. Jews were overwhelmingly overrepresented in communist subversion. Jews with internationalist, communist, Zionist, and Talmudic leanings were essentially operating as a fifth column and a Trojan horse within Germany, trying to destabilize the country for the Bolsheviks to take over. The Germans knew about the Jewish forces behind the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia and the Red Terror that followed. Germany would be next in line, and hadn't the Germans stopped the Jewish Bolsheviks, the whole of Europe would have fallen. So this is why the communists, the greater part of which were Jewish, were interned in labor camps to get useful work out of them during the war until they could be deported.
The Jews were responsible for her defeat. They naturally resented it, but not a hair on the head of any Jew was harmed. Not a single hair. Professor Tanzel of Georgetown University, who had access to all the secret papers of the State Department, wrote in his book and quoted from a State Department document written by Hugo Schoenfeld, a Jew who Cordell Hull sent to Europe in 1933 to investigate the so-called camps of political prisoners. And he wrote back that he found them in very fine condition. They were in excellent shape, everybody treated well, and they were filled with communists. Well, a lot of them were Jews, because the Jews happened to be maybe 98% of the communists in Europe at that time. And there were some priests there and ministers, labor leaders, masons, and others who had international affiliations.
Typhus, a fatal disease caused by the Rickettsia bacteria, ravaged the armies of both World War I and World War II, and also claimed the lives of prisoners in those labor camps. Typhus has historically always been linked to wars and crowded conditions, and is spread by external parasites such as lice, fleas, and ticks. The inmates in the German camps would have their hair deloused through chemical showers or have their hair shaved off. Clothes and shoes were also discarded and replaced. Cyclone B was an insecticide and pesticide that killed the lice that carried typhus. This chemical was used to improve the inmates' health and reduce, not increase, camp mortality.
Zaktum was used for a hygienic purpose, killing bugs, not Jews, that the gas chambers had clothing put in, not people. They were hygienic, not homicidal. And the alleged homicidal gas chambers that are written up in the book, huge Holocaust textbooks, these do not have any elevation of cyanide in the walls above normal background levels. And it's a pretty damn simple conclusion.
Cyclin B was produced by the German company Degesch. It was also used since 1929 in the United States by the U.S. Public Health Service at the border with Mexico to delouse and disinfect Mexican immigrants that passed from Juarez to El Paso. DDT was later used as a more effective chemical. During the end of the war, Allied terror bombings destroyed most of German cities, infrastructure, food and water supplies, railroads and medicine factories. The labor camps could no longer be supplied with adequate food, and the situation in Germany deteriorated fast, and deadly typhus epidemics broke out in Germany's internment camps. Consequently, many of the prisoners could not be fed and were left to starve. By the time the Allied forces swept through Germany, they saw the warning signs outside of the camps. No entrance, typhus epidemic. Upon the liberation of the camps, they were met with a ghastly scene of prisoners in the last stages of typhus and piles of diseased and emaciated corpses. By that time, most prisoners had either died or were dying through starvation or typhus. The Allies were shocked and appalled to find the dire conditions of what their bombing campaigns had helped to create. Even after the Allies liberated the camps, thousands of prisoners died like flies. In fact, the death rate at Bergen-Belsen actually increased after the British took over the camp. Footage was then recorded and shown to the international community, and Germany would once again be attacked and blamed.
You were on the scene in Belsen as a young man.
Yes, I went with a group of medical students and we arrived in Belsen on May the 2nd, 1945, and I first went to the camp on May the 3rd. Himmler ordered the camp to be seeded on April the 11th in order to stop typhus, which was an epidemic spreading throughout Europe. The British came in, the tank division came in on April the 15th at 3 o'clock, and they did their best to segregate the typhus and the dying from the others.
How many people were in the camp at the time when the British took over the camp?
I think there were about 57 or 60,000. The British bombed everything and the Americans that moved on the roads. So that getting food there was extremely difficult. The water supplies became contaminated with sewage, and the administration in the camp more or less broke down.
Even, let's say, if the German camp administration had made maximum effort and had been given everything at hand, could they have prevented this?
There was no cure for typhus at that time. The British put DDT, which is an insecticide, over everything and everybody. And in that way, I think the typhus was contained. But it was a great danger. People didn't realize it was typhus. I suppose 56% of people died who got it.
Why are these bodies naked? I mean, some of them are so emaciated, why don't they have their clothing on?
Well, they did, and when they were pushed outside of the huts, they had clothing on, but clothing was so scarce, everything was scarce, that the inmates would immediately rush out and take all the clothing off, because it was a pity to waste it. That's why they were naked.
Did you see, when you got there 2 weeks after the British Army took over, any evidence of gas chambers, the way propaganda has said that the Germans had in these camps? Or was there any claim made to that effect?
No. I don't think it was ever thought that there was a gas chamber in Belsenberg. People were dying at 500 a day, by the way, right? 500 a day.
Even under the British administration.
Under British administration, yes. And what was happening was that the English soldiers were giving people their food, and people half starved and had very thin stomachs, and the stomach would burst and they'd die. The inmates said that they conditions there, this is what the inmates said, that conditions weren't too bad until the end of 44, and then this mass immigration. But by the time they put in another 50,000, of course, they...
Now, I read in German language books, and I'm not sure if it's accurate or not, but that Britain broke a promise to those soldiers to let them go to their own lines, and that there was rather brutal treatment on the part of some of the British soldiers against those Germans.
I don't know where you read it, because I never knew to find it, but that's what we understood, that most of them had been finished off. That really upset me, because I thought that, you know, we were fighting a war for ideals and honour, and this was the most dishonourable thing to agree to, give and safe conduct back to alliance. And then those that stayed, because a lot slipped away, and beat them up.
Yeah. Were you there during the time when the bulldozers were actually putting these bodies in the graves? In these long trenches that you see?
The bodies were being thrown in. They were put. The truck went round every day and picked up the bodies outside the hut. Mm-hmm. And then they were taken to where the bulldozer had dug the grave, and they were thrown into the grave.
But we were all put into what looked like a great big bathroom, I guess, because they had these shower things at the top, and we were put onto benches. We were all stark naked, old and young. Of course, the sexes were separated, but we all had to sit in a row. And what happened eventually is that they rained from the shower heads. They rained soap and water on us. And the reason for that was that we had to be deloused. We were so full of lice through that. Our hair was cut, and they rained soap and water on us. And I do not remember if there were any towels. So when I hear about the shower heads and the Holocaust and all of that, I know exactly what it was. That was soap and water raining down on us to delouse us. That's what it was. And where the story came from that those were dangerous shower heads, I don't know. That must have come out of the Russian propaganda.
It's like Steven Spielberg.
Everybody
in Schindler's List is waiting for the gas to come in.
And all it
is. Lo and behold, all it was
is soap and water came raining down on us in this great big, we called it banya, which is a Russian word for a washroom.
Bathroom.
But it was a big one, a communal bathroom. It was huge, I would say. It was, the way I remember it, of course I was little, but the way I remember it, I would say it was at least 30 by 30. It must have been built for that purpose, to wash us down like dogs. The same for the cutting of hair. I mean, we were all shorn bald in order to stop the louse problem that we had. Everybody had lice in the war, you know. I mean, this was just common knowledge that everybody had lice. And then, of course, we had to be deloused and put into Germany.
So Jews cannot claim unique victim status.
They cannot. And when I hear the stories about them losing their hair, big deal. None of us had hair. So that was my take on it.
And how about the cattle cars?
Well, the cattle cars was pretty much the same story, because we considered ourselves lucky if we could ride in a cattle car, of course, because then we did not depend on horses. We did not have to walk on foot. Man, that was luxury. To ride a cattle car, and yes, they were crammed full of people, and yes, it was very difficult, you know, to travel like that. You could not sit, you had to stand, because they were crammed full. Often there was not water, there was no food. This is how it was in those years. People were hanging on those cattle cars. When you see those pictures, that could have been us. We were like that in those years. That means nothing. The same when you see the bunk beds. My goodness, we were lucky if we had bunk beds where we could sleep at night. It meant we did not have to sleep outside in the snow. And frankly, we never really heard much about the persecution of the Jews. We knew that there were executions happening in Russia, but in Germany proper, I do not remember a single time that I heard any of these stories ever, or later on in South America for that matter. I have to struggle to find memories of even the slightest anti-Semitism. And it was one of my happiest times there, because they were so kind to us and so good to us and played with us and gave us toys and, you know, fussed over us. And never ever in all those times was any one of these young soldiers improper with us. Never. It's of the war that is my happiest time.
Documents from the German camps shows an order that Heinrich Himmler, chief of the concentration camp, issued orders on December 28, 1942 that the death rate in the concentration camps must be reduced at all costs. The camps were mainly factories, and the loss of workers was hurting war production. Inspector of the camps, Richard Glucks, responded to Himmler's order on January 20, 1943. Every means should be used to lower the death rates in the camp. Already in 1937, several German newspapers reported that murdering Jews would be punishable by death. Joseph Reinhardt had been sentenced to death for killing a Jewish merchant Abraham and his Gentile wife. Murder was murder, regardless of the victim. In the camps were camp complaint offices, where inmates could register complaints or make suggestions. A system of strict discipline for both guards and for inmates, with severe punishment being handed out against those found guilty. If any guard would attack a prisoner, the guard would be punished for it, often with death. There was also a prison in the camp, where dangerous or criminal people were placed. The German SS arrested Buchenwald commandant Karl Koch in 1943 for mistreating some prisoners. After an investigation, Koch was found guilty by SS judge Konrad Morgan and shot. Jewish scholar Arno Mayer, a professor of history at Princeton University, acknowledged in his 1988 book about the Final Solution that more Jews perished at Auschwitz as a result of typhus and other natural causes than were executed.
There is nothing murderous about cremation ovens. Many dead bodies were cremated because Auschwitz was built on marsh ground. Hence, decomposing typhus corpses would have poisoned the drinking water and spread fatal diseases. Ellis Island in USA had similar disinfection and cremation facilities as those in the German camps. In fact, the procedures at the German camps were essentially the same as those used at Ellis Island by the United States. They served the exact same purpose, to keep disease from spreading. Today in the United States, the use of crematoria is even more common than it ever was in Germany then. The mass killings and gassing stories originated with Soviet reports authorized by the known liars in genocidal mass murders around Ilya Ehrenberg and Joe Stalin, which then was spread by the Jewish-owned New York Times. The story was spread just hours after Germany's surrender, which made it impossible for any falsely accused German to refute Soviet's claims. There is, in fact, no scientific proof that Jews were gassed. There is no evidence of gassing deaths. There are no German documents to identify any gassing victim, no order from Hitler, no mass graves of gassed Jews. At Nuremberg, the existence of the gas chambers was never even demonstrated. Thousands of secret German documents dealing with the concentration camps were confiscated after the war, but not a single one refers to a policy or program of extermination. In a letter to the US State Department dated November 22, 1944, the Red Cross, who were stationed in all of the camps, stated, "We have not been able to discover any trace of installations for exterminating civilian prisoners." The Vatican and Red Cross interviewed thousands of freed camp inmates at the end of the war about the alleged gas chambers. The response was always the same: no, the detainees themselves have not spoken of them. All forensic chemical examination have disproven the use of cyclin B in the alleged homicidal gas chambers. US expert on execution technologies Fred Leuchter traveled to Auschwitz and covertly obtained samples from the alleged gas chambers. He had them tested and published his results. Based on chemical analysis on wall samples and on various technical arguments, Leuchter concluded that the locations investigated could not then been or now be utilized or seriously considered to function as execution gas chambers.
With the exception of the video photographer, I brought the same things that I would have normally brought to a prison in the United States if I was doing a survey of their equipment. The draftsman was there to take and verify measurements. The drawings were made on site and then reproduced when we returned to the United States to document everything we saw. I personally made photographs and produced a great deal of photographic evidence of the hardware and facilities that we found in Poland. And the video photographer, which was not a normal thing for me, was brought to document the fact that the forensic samples that I removed from the facilities, the control sample from the Delousing facility number one of Birkenau, and all of the other samples from the alleged gas execution rooms were properly taken, packaged, packaged for submission to the laboratories. I examined the facilities, and I made a determination that they were incapable of supporting the use of hydrogen cyanide gas for purposes of execution or otherwise. But additionally, it would be necessary to remove samples, return them to the United States for testing at an independent laboratory to in fact confirm what my visual inspection indicated, that these facilities never in fact contained hydrogen cyanide gas. The requirements necessary in the design of a facility that contains a highly explosive and highly poisonous gas. You must have gasketed doors, no windows, means of getting the gas in, means of getting the gas out, something for heating the gas and the air to constantly keep the right temperature, explosion-proof switches, lighting facilities, etc. None of these ever existed. We're talking about brick and mortar buildings without heat, with non-explosion proof lighting, without gasketed doors, in some cases without doors at all, and with crematories that opened very close or adjacent to the facility. If these facilities were used for gas execution facilities, if those persons operating the facilities didn't gas themselves to death at the same time that the executees died, they certainly would have been blown to bits when the gas exploded from a spark arc in a switch, the heat of a light bulb, or the gas approaching and getting into the crematory furnace. I mean, it's just ludicrous to consider that these facilities could have been used as gas chambers. None of the facilities examined at Auschwitz, Birkenau, or Lublin could have supported, or in fact did ever support, multiple executions utilizing hydrogen cyanide, carbon monoxide, or any other allegedly or factually lethal gas. Based upon very generous maximum usage rates for all the alleged gas chambers, totaling some 1,693 persons per week, and assuming these facilities could support gas executions, it would have required 68 years to execute the alleged number of 6 million persons. Promoting these facilities as being capable of effecting mass, multiple, or even singular executions is both ludicrous and insulting to every individual on this planet.
Guillermo Rudolph is a chemist who, in the winter of 1990 to 91, while working towards a doctorate in chemistry at the renowned Max Planck Institute for Solid-State Physics in Stuttgart, began a scientific investigation of the credibility of the Leuchter report. His detailed chemical analysis concluded that hydrocyanic acid was not used in the buildings alleged to have been homicidal gas chambers at Auschwitz. His report strengthens the findings of Fred Leuchter. The prominent Austrian engineer Walter Lüftl also made a report concluding that the homicidal gassings were impossible for technical reasons and because they are incompatible with observable laws of nature. Lüftl's report is further authoritative confirmation of the findings of Fred Leuchter. The American research chemist Dr. William B. Lindsay also made careful examinations of the alleged gas chambers. After 33 years of experience as a chemist, he declared and affirmed under oath, "I have come to the conclusion that no one was willfully or purposefully killed with Cyclone B in this manner. I consider it impossible." the Krakow Forensic Institute, Robert Farrison, Fredrik Turbin, John Ball, Carlo Martono, Jürgen Graf, Ernst Sündel, David McAlden, and many others who also have carried out similar technical inspections of the alleged gas chambers have come to the same conclusion. A brave Jewish revisionist named David Cole made a groundbreaking documentary called Cole in Auschwitz in 1992. Today, there are many feature-length documentaries, analyses, and commentary on the German labor camps. In 1999, Rieke Krieg, a qualified electronics engineer, and his team of researchers carried out a high-tech exam of the soil in the alleged death camp Treblinka. Using ground-penetrating radar for 3 weeks, the team found that the ground was never even disturbed, and core samples revealed no ash. The results obtained show with 100% certainty that mass graves never even existed in Treblinka or Belzec. There are, in fact, many mass graves in the East. However, this was where the Soviets massacred people. Today it is well known that, for example, the Katy massacre was committed by the Soviets, but was blamed on the Germans after the war. Dr. Charles Larson, one of America's leading forensic pathologists as part of a US war crimes investigation team, performed more than 1,000 autopsies of the dead bodies in the German camps, and none showed any evidence of death by poison gas. If there had been gassings with carbon monoxide or cyanide, the indications would have been extremely dramatic and readily visible. The corpses would have been bright sherry red. No Prussian blue cyanide staining was found on walls in the alleged death chambers. Only in the delousing chambers are ample amounts of evidence of gassings, where Cyclone B was used on clothes and bedding to stop the spread of typhus. The Auschwitz Museum curator admitted that the Soviets created the homicidal gas chamber after the war by altering a German bomb shelter. In the bomb shelter presented to us as a homicidal gas chamber in Auschwitz, the communists removed the walls and made the infamous Cyclone B holes in the roof to make it look like a real gas chamber.
Now, when you go into that Crema 1 building, you're going to see it. It just looks kind of weird. It has all these dirt mounds all around it. It looks like a bomb shelter. And that's exactly what it was at the end of the war. It was a bomb shelter. They want you to think that 4 million people went through Auschwitz, and they made it look like all the people went through that camp there. But that building there was not capable or made for gassing people, all right, at all. I mean, you know, you go inside it, they chop holes in the roof at the end, and it's just ridiculous. I mean, there's no way people were killed in that building. So they want you to believe that this is the building that people were gassed in. It just wasn't feasible that people were gassed in that building.
The thing now, that building, where they end the tour, that was never a gas chamber. There was a chimney next to it, and there were four holes in the ceiling where the Cyclone B granules would be dumped, and people would see the holes, and they could explore them and look around. What I did in 92, I interviewed the man who was the director, the curator, for lack of a better word, of the camp, and he admitted to me on camera, not a hidden camera shoot, it was an open two-camera shoot in his office. It was me and my camera woman. And he admitted on camera that the building displayed as the gas chamber is not in its original state, that when the Soviets liberated the camp, that building was an air raid shelter, a very obvious, very clear air raid shelter. And then the Soviets remodeled it to look like what their conception of a gas chamber is. Now, there's no backup evidence to prove that this building was ever a gas chamber. There's no Cyclone Blue cyanide staining on the walls. There were no four holes in the roof to dump in the Cyclone B. The Soviets added those There had been dividing walls. Inside the room, the Soviets knock those down to make it look like one big open chamber. They ripped up the bathroom facilities. You can still see the drains in the floor. You can still see the holes where the toilet and the sink had led into. But they took out all the facilities and they carved a doorway where there had not been a door to make it look like there was a progression from the gas chamber to the oven room. But there was a lot of stuff that they didn't bother to cover up. There's a gigantic manhole right in the middle of the gas chamber.
Yeah.
A manhole that any adult, even a fairly heavyset adult, can go down into. Now, what that is, that was an escape hatch, was fairly standard design procedure that underground or partially underground bomb shelters would have an escape hatch in case rubble or anything else prevented the people inside from exiting the bomb shelter through the main door. So you have this manhole that no one had noticed. For at that point, Auschwitz, when I went there in 91, Auschwitz had been open to the West for over a decade. No one ever noticed the damn manhole, and it's right there, clear as day. The door to the chamber opens in. In other words, if it was a gas chamber and you stuck people in there and they would all pile up against the door trying to bang their way out, they would die there. In order to open the door again, you'd have to push against a mound of 50, 100, 200, 300 bodies. The door locks on the inside, not the outside. In other words, the victims would be able to lock the Germans out, which is just kind of a silly thing to think of.
In January 1995, the prestigious French weekly magazine, L'Express, acknowledged that everything about this gas chamber is false, and that it is in fact a deceitful post-war reconstruction. French Jewish Olga Wormser-Migot wrote a book about the National Socialist concentration camps, in which she stated, "Auschwitz, which was to remain the model camp and simultaneously the administrative center, had no gas chamber. A fake chimney was also built by the Soviets in 1947. It has no opening, and it is not even connected to the building."
German prisoners were also forced to alter a shower room at Sachsenhausen to support a Soviet show trial, but the forgery was so crude and embarrassing that the communists had to knock down the building in 1952. Hundreds of people of all sorts came and went into the German working camps all day long, supplying the camps with food and supplies of all kinds. Yet no one has ever mentioned, and yet no one has ever admitted to seeing any evidence of homicidal gas chambers, the colossal amount of fuel required, the thousands of dead bodies every hour, or the dust. Aerial photos show the same lack of evidence. Detailed Allied aerial investigation photographs taken of the German camps every day during the summer of 1944 were made public in 1979. Not even CIA experts could find the slightest trace of piles of human corpses, smoke in crematoria chimneys, or masses of Jews awaiting deaths or gassing. The horrifying pictures of heaps of corpses we have been shown as proof of a systematic extermination of Jews by the evil Nazis are in fact misleading. All footage of dead camp inmates are of those who died of typhus and malnutrition in Western camps during the final weeks of the war. And this is confirmed by German military, Red Cross, and British military medical records. Even mainstream historians now agree that mass murders or homicidal gassings never took place in any of the camps from where the Allied footage are taken. Unfortunately, this is never pointed out whenever the footage is shown. So they try to sell you a story, but now you know the truth. In fact, the Allied saturation bombings are directly responsible for many of these tragic deaths. It is also important to note that most of these dead bodies are not even Jewish. A large number of the bodies were in reality the direct result of Allied bombing and strafing attacks. Images of Nordhausen are used all over the major media, but it has been proven that these prisoners were blown up and strafed by British warplanes, and they were not exterminated by the Germans, as the official story goes.
And there I had over 4,000 prisoners laying on tuberculosis. Sick. What are you doing with tuberculosis? No medications, nothing, hardly food. It was very meager already. The Germans didn't have to eat. And all of a sudden, it was April 3rd at 3 o'clock, alarm, and American Air Force over us and dropped the bombs just on our camp. But the whole camp was entirely destroyed. And out of this 4,000 people, we were 200 survived. Because they died there, they were in the camps, you know, hanging in the ceiling, dead bodies. And it was awful. It was burning days and days. We were still, if this, the nurses, the doctors, administration people working on administration, we ran away. And the Americans made a mistake because they didn't know this is a concentration camp. They knew it is a military camp. They emptied the military a month before, and in January we put us in, you see. So they didn't know. So they came back at 9 o'clock in the morning and hit the whole city. The whole city, they flattened. We ran away in the wood, in the fields, and when they emptied the planes, they came and strafed us with machine guns at them. You could know who it is. This one, they are Germans, you know. And we went into the wood, and we remained about a week in the woods. And we ate only the raw potatoes.
What about all these pictures? Well, you have seen dead, primarily political prisoners, either killed by starvation, disease, indirectly or directly due to Allied bombings. When the Soviets took over the camps, they were reopened and filled with Germans and other anti-communists. After the communists had tortured and starved them to death, photos of these prisoners were also passed off as victims of Hitler's Holocaust. Pictures from these massacres committed by the Soviets and even dead Germans from the Allied bombings of Dresden were also spliced into the propaganda and used as proof of Jewish dead. Even though we now know the truth about the footage, the pictures have now become emblematic of the Holocaust, and our media still use them to mislead the public. The leading think tank for Holocaust revisionism is the Institute for Historical Review, an independent and non-profit organization committed in the education of World War II. In 1979, IHR publicly offered a reward of $50,000 for verifiable proof that the homicidal gas chambers existed. It was challenged by Mel Marmelstein, a Hungarian-born Jew. He declared that he saw his mother and two sisters lured into gas chambers. He used his own autobiographical memoir, By Bread Alone, as proof. In the book, he describes how his father told him that his mother and sister had been burned alive. He would later say in his book that his uncle heard that his mother and sister had been led to the gas chambers. He would change his story once again in a letter published in a California newspaper, saying that he had witnessed his own mother and his two sisters being led through a tunnel to gas chamber number 5, even though there was no gas chamber number 5 or a tunnel that led to it. Judge Thomas Johnson of the Superior Court of California ruled against IHR and rewarded Marmelstein $70,000, stating that the gassings of the Jews is not a reasonable subject to dispute, as it's simply a fact. It was reported already during World War I that the Germans and their allies were using gas chambers to kill thousands of prisoners. Jewish-controlled media even had used the magical numbers 6 million and the magical words
Extermination and Holocaust. An article printed in Britain's The Daily Telegraph on March 22, 1916, stated that the Austrians and Bulgarians were killing people by shutting them up in churches and suffocating them with poison gas. Some of the other propaganda lies said that the Germans were cutting off children's hands, crucifying Canadian soldiers, making human soap in a corpse factory, gouging out the eyes of civilians, cutting off the hands of the teenage boys, raping and sexually mutilating women, giving children hand grenades to play with, and bayoneting babies. After the end of the war, Stanley Baldwin admitted in Parliament that it all had been propaganda, and that no such gas chambers had existed. He also apologized publicly to the German people for this racist slur on them. On December 2, 1925, British Foreign Secretary Austen Chamberlain admitted that none of the atrocity propaganda was true and hoped that it would never happen again. After World War II, this false anti-German propaganda was spread once again. During and after World War II, the Allies used atrocity propaganda against Germany to distract people from the atrocities being committed primarily by the Red Army. In a February 29, 1944 letter to the BBC and higher members of the British clergy from the British Ministry of Information read, "We know the methods of rule employed by the Bolshevik dictator in Russia itself, from, for example, the writing and speeches of the Prime Minister himself during the last 20 years. We know how the Red Army behaved in Poland in 1920 and in Finland, Estonia, Latvia, Galicia and Bessarabia only recently. We must therefore take into account how the Red Army will certainly behave when it overruns Central Europe. Unless precautions are taken, the obviously inevitable horrors which will result will throw an undue strain on public opinion in this country. We cannot reform the Bolsheviks, but we can do our best to save them and ourselves from the consequences of their acts. The disclosure of the past quarter of a century will render mere denials unconvincing. The only alternative to denial is to distract public attention from the whole subject. Experience has shown that the best distraction is atrocity propaganda directed against the enemy. Unfortunately, the public is no longer as susceptible as in the days of the corpse factory and the mutilated Belgian babies and the crucified Canadians. Your cooperation is therefore earnestly sought to distract public attentions from the doings of the Red Army by your wholehearted support of various charges against the Germans and Japanese, which have been and will be put in circulation by the ministry." In other words, the letter can be summed up like this. We all know the crimes like the Holodomor and the Red Terror committed by the Bolsheviks over the last 24 years. It is inevitable that they will do the same in Central Europe. We will cover up their crimes by lying about the Germans. The public is not as stupid as it was. Our lies will be better. You must spread these lies convincingly. This reminds us that truth really is the first victim of war. This was essentially the start of what turned into what we know today as the Holocaust, as the control media started spitting out even more horrific propaganda against Germany. Basically everything that the propaganda blamed Hitler and the Germans for were the Bolsheviks themselves guilty of.
Propaganda allowed these crimes to happen, and then propaganda took over when the crimes were committed and basically projected the crimes back upon the vanquished. The victors just turned it around and blamed everything on those they had slaughtered and raped.
After the war, where did all these stories come from, which we hear now no end of? It became because the Jews realized they were going to get Israel out of it as a motivation for telling stories. And then as well as that, as if that weren't enough, Germany starts giving funds for every so-called Holocaust survivor. Holocaust survivor just has to have a story about them being in Europe and surviving the Holocaust, and then they get money from Germany. So you've got a reward for every story.
The Jewish-British journalist Sefton Delmer was the head of Black Propaganda. Black propaganda is false information and material that purports to be from a source on one side of a conflict, but it's actually from the opposing side. It is typically used to vilify, embarrass, or misrepresent the enemy. OSS, forerunner of CIA, also faked documents and diaries. Revisionists are convinced that the black propaganda is a fundamental factor behind the Holocaust propaganda. Atrocity propaganda is how we won the war, and we are only really beginning with it now. We will continue this atrocity propaganda. We will escalate it until nobody will accept even a good word from the Germans, until all the sympathy they may still have abroad will have been destroyed, and they themselves will be so confused that they will no longer know what they're doing. Once that has been achieved, once they begin to run down their own country and their own people, not reluctantly, but with eagerness to please the victors, only then will our victory be complete. It will never be final. Re-education needs careful tending, like an English lawn. Even one moment of negligence, and the weeds crop up again, those indestructible weeds of historical truth. In September 1940, Sefton was recruited by the political warfare executive to organize black propaganda and allied psychological warfare. Sefton's special method was lying as exactly as possible so that the lies couldn't be uncovered right away. Until 1947, Delmer coordinated the black propaganda campaign with the French, the Soviets, and the Americans. During this period, he and his staff forged German documents about alleged German war crimes, which reached official files. Delmer provided the documents to the British Ministry of Information, which in turn sent them to the Nuremberg trials as official documents. Without checking whether the documents were true or false, they were presented as evidence of generally known facts. The propaganda after the war blamed Germany for starting the war, censored all Allied atrocities, and depicted the Soviet Union as a utopia. General Eisenhower also rounded up German villagers and forced them to see what they had done. Audiences were horrified by newsreel footage of the Nazi concentration camps. One full-length film directed by Eisenhower showed the shrunken heads of inmates and lampshades that supposedly were made from human flesh. German civilians were rounded up and forced to view it all to install shame and horror in them. Within a week of the capture of Buchenwald, the Jewish Hollywood director Billy Wilder was in the camp making a film of propaganda lies that still circulate to this day. The film was called Death Mills, Die Todesmühle in German, and was made for the Psychological Warfare Department of the US Department of War. Its purpose was to indoctrinate the Germans to believe that the National Socialists were evil in order to shame the Germans away from nationalism and racial consciousness. The film claimed that the Nazis made soap from the fat of Jewish prisoners, made lampshades from the skin of prisoners, and shrunk the heads of prisoners like in the Amazon. Modern science has determined these horrific claims from Buchenwald and Bergen-Belsen to be absurd Allied propaganda. It all has been debunked as fabrication. Even Jewish scholars as Deborah Lipstadt now admit that these were all propaganda lies. DNA tests proved that the shrunken heads were fakes. The soap was ordinary soap. The lampshades were made of goat leather, and there were never any homicidal gassings at the camps. Tales of gas chambers disguised as shower rooms are wartime atrocity fiction, similar to previously debunked claims about Jews being made into soap and lampshades. The shrunken heads hoax was the creation of Albert G. Rosenberg, a Jewish officer serving in Eisenhower's psychological warfare unit. Even though these things have been debunked as hoaxes, they are repeated by the lying, hate-filled Zionists.
They would kill the infants and make lampshades out of baby skins or soap of baby fat.
I showed a pit in Auschwitz where they made soap from people. Throw in people and took the fat and make soap for the German military. Boiling water. Big pool.
We have soap made out of human beings.
R.I.F. meant rein Jewish fat. Pure Jewish fat.
R.J.F. And RJF meant rein Jüdisches Fett, translated clean Jewish fat.
Pure Jewish soap, you know, rein Juden fat.
Pure Jewish fat, rein Jüdisches Fett.
Yeah, rein Jüdisches Fett.
Piece of soap said, has gestickten Judenseife, made out of Jewish fat.
In 1944, another book was written which advocated the denazification and mass psychological brainwashing of the German people. It was called What to Do with Germany and was written by prominent B'nai B'rith member Louis Nitzer. Nitzer was a wealthy Jewish lawyer from New York and was also a colleague of Theodor Kaufmann and Harry Morgenthau, Franklin D. Roosevelt's Secretary of the Treasury and the author of the Morgenthau Plan. Nitzer wanted to turn the Germans into brainwashed conformative zombies. National Socialist teachers would be replaced. Media would demonize and dehumanize the German people. National Socialism would be depicted as the most evil ideology. German books would be destroyed in huge book burnings to destroy German culture and the collective German memory. As part of the propaganda campaign to demonize the Germans, the Soviets and others also forged many photographs which are used to represent Holocaust atrocities. Pictures of dead Germans now became pictures of dead Jews. Pictures of National Socialists became pictures of evil, racist Nazis. Photos of German refugees became photos of Jews. The anti-German propaganda that started after the war by the Jewish-owned media was going to continue for over 70 years in the future. During an appearance on the Larry King television show, actor Marlon Brando dared to comment that
I think that I'm angry with some of the Jews. I'm very goddamn angry at some of the Jews. Hollywood is run by Jews. It's owned by Jews. They should have a greater sensitivity about the issue of people who are suffering.
Ariel Sharon admitted in 2001 that we, the Jewish people, control America and the Americans know it. The Jewish supremacist journalist Elad Nirai said, "Let's be honest with ourselves here, fellow Jews. We do control the media. We got so many dudes up in the executive offices in all the big movie production companies. It's almost obscene. Did you know that all 8 major film studios are run by Jews?" Joel Stein, columnist for the Los Angeles Times, in his column in the LA Times in 2008, Stein says that Americans who think the Jews do not control Hollywood and the media are just plain dumb. He says, "I want America to know of our accomplishment. Yes, we control Hollywood. I don't care if Americans think we're running the news, media, or Hollywood, Wall Street, or the government. I just care that we get to keep running them." Jews totally run Hollywood, Stein proudly admits. He then goes on to provide a long, long list of Hollywood media owners who all are Jews to prove his point. Today, 6 Jewish companies control 96% of the world's media. The so-called denazification has never stopped. For 7 decades, we have only heard one side of the story. There have been thousands of books, films, and TV series dedicated to the Holocaust to frighten people from the National Socialist ideology. One of the most known movies that has influenced how people see Germany's role in World War II has undoubtedly been The Schindler's List. Sold out to the public as a true story and filmed in black and white for a claim to authenticity. Despite this fictional film containing nudity and murder, it is continually shown in European and American schools as mandatory viewing for history education. It portrays the Germans as evil monsters who only cared for one thing, killing innocent Jews. However, the film was based upon a fiction book called
Schindler's List, which won the LA Times Book Award for Fiction, authored by Thomas Kennelly. The author himself has no experience of the camps. So here we have a film being shown to our children as truth when it's actually based upon a work of fiction. In other words, it is not truth. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either products of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. Impressionable children in middle school are also instructed to read The Diary of Anne Frank, which now probably is the pinnacle of the Holocaust theory. The 15-year-old girl Anne Frank and her father, Otto Frank, were deported from the Netherlands to Auschwitz in September 1944. Otto was treated in the hospital at Auschwitz. Several weeks later, in the face of the advancing Soviet army, Anne was evacuated along with many others to the overcrowded Bergen-Belsen camp. Tens of thousands of Jewish survivors chose to leave Auschwitz and go west by January of 1945 with the very same people who had supposedly been murdering them every day for years. Anne Frank died of typhus in March 1945. However, the original diary manuscript was forensically examined by the German State Forensic Bureau, the Bundeskriminalamt. Their analysis determined that significant portions of the work were written with a ballpoint pen. Since ballpoint pens were not available to everyone before 1951, portions of the work were added well after the war. Handwriting experts determined after closer examination of the originals that all of the writing in the diary was by the same hand, and the BKA determined that none of the diary handwriting matched known examples of Anne's real handwriting. The true author of the diary was Jewish novelist Meir Levine, who demanded and was awarded $50,000 in payments for his work in a court action against Anne's father, Otto Frank. The truth about the Anne Frank diary was first exposed in 1959 by the Swedish journal Fria Ord. It established that the Jewish novelist Meir Levine had written the dialogue of the diary and was demanding payment for his work in a court action against Otto Frank. An extract from the Swedish articles appeared in the American Economic Council letter, April 15, 1959, as follows. History has many examples of myths that live a longer and richer life than truth, and may become more effective than truth. The Western world has for some years been made aware of a Jewish girl through the medium of what purports to be her personally written story, Anne Frank's diary. Any informed literary inspection of this book would have shown it to have been impossible as the work of a teenager. A noteworthy decision of the New York State Supreme Court confirms this point of view, in that the well-known American Jewish writer, Meir Levine, has been awarded $50,000 to be paid him by the father of Anne Frank as an honorarium for Levine's work on the Anne Frank diary. Evidence compiled by Dr. Robert Farrison of France establishes that the famous diary is a literary hoax. After doing substantial research, Professor Farrison stated, "The truth obliged me to say that the diary of Anne Frank is only a simple literary fraud." The Jewish-German communist Bruno Baum admitted to being one of the main fabricators of propaganda at the Auschwitz camp. He said, "It is no exaggeration when I say that the majority of all Auschwitz propaganda was written by ourselves in the camp. We carried out this propaganda in for the world public until our very last day of presence in Auschwitz." The evil Germans actually went to great lengths to keep the inmates well fed, well housed, and entertained in the German camps. The camps had decent, sufficient food until the last weeks of the war, when the Allies had bombed all infrastructure of Germany into oblivion.
We also had an orchestra where some of the musicians stood together, and one musician was so good that he had the instruments playing and he wrote the notes. So later on we had a band who played over the weekend, and that was of course helping us. You know, we also did plays and stuff.
Were there any cultural activities happening in Auschwitz?
Yes. I told you we had a piano put into a, not just a piano, a grand piano was brought into block one. Once that was built, that new block, the downstairs room was assigned for theater. When he wanted to build a stage curtain in that new block one, which was one, the big dining room was going to be also with a stage, so performances could be done for women there, cultural. He said, for heaven's sake, isn't there anybody here who can help me sew on these curtain rings for the stage? I do it for you, he says. And I came forward and I helped him with the curtain stage. And that was wonderful because I had a man sitting across me for a change. And my roommate is in charge of work assignments. And if you happen to know music, what instruments do you play? I said, I learned piano, but not good enough for an orchestra. I can tell you that right now. And he said, well, then maybe you know the notes. I said, yes. He said, well, then I can use you because we have to write it from the original music piece what the director gets to the instruments. And so from each instrument has only a short line on the whole paper. So I had to take it apart and write for each instrument from that what I had to do. That I had to even make the lines. We didn't have paper that was pre-printed for notes, nothing. So I spent the whole day there for a while until we were taken away from Auschwitz. But then she saw me work there. I had a big table where I could work and lay out all the paper, and it was very peaceful and relaxing. And Otto wanted to talk more to me. That is when I met that SS man at one time. That was the last job I did while I was in Auschwitz. And when I, the other job, that when I was in Block 10, we went out to pick the leaves. And from these leaves, they would make tea for the whole camp, for the whole Auschwitz.
How did you entertain yourselves?
Well, there were, at the beginning of those days, there was a library where you could, people could get books to read. There were newspapers that we could get. And that, and also among ourselves, sometimes we had a violin quartet. We used to come and play in barracks during the evening. That was, and later on, and they said they're gonna build a movie in the camp, and we prayed. The prisoner said, "Only you must be crazy. They're gonna make a movie for us in the camp." And really, it happened. They made a movie in the camp. Yeah, and we went in barracks after barracks. We could go to see a movie sometimes in the evening. They brought movies in to see in the evening. And
what kind of movies would they show?
Well, German movies. But once I came to the main camp, they were allowed twice a month to write home. Once a postcard and once a letter.
They gave you the materials?
Yeah, they gave us the letter, the materials, and we could
How did you get the stamps?
Stamps. We could buy stamps. We could
you had
buy.
Money?
Yeah, we got money, we still got money with the money we got through the Jewish community from Vienna who sent us everybody some money.
And in the camp you could have currency?
You yeah, they could have money because there was in camp also what they call a cantina. And not many times, but once in a while they sold a few cigarettes or they sold something, whatever they had. So if you had money, you could buy in the cantina there. Food, there wasn't really any food really. They usually sold, and sometimes they sold some weak beer they sold also in the
cantina.
Yeah. But not really anything else, not much, mostly cigarettes.
And when you went to the movies, did you have to pay?
Yes, we had to pay. after the money stopped, the regular money stopped, we got paid in coupons then.
Paid for your work?
Well, I don't know if it was for whatever, we got paid for in coupons, for which were redeemable in that container if they had something. So that was their way of distributing money then to everybody. Everybody got this money then.
Of course, what we did is for the weekends, we got together, we got a group of us together, and we made a soccer team, which was a little later, where we played soccer.
Well, it's amazing that there would be a soccer team, that there'd be enough energy left to do something like that.
Well, I don't think we were quite as energetic as we were with the other regular team, but we did something to, you know, it kept our mind off of the problems we had.
Especially the Germans start losing the war, 1943-44. So 1944, we had soccer games in Gross Rose. Soccer teams, we had we organized very well. Soccer teams, each nationality organized a soccer team. And we organized our equipment, everything, and play soccer on the assembly line, on the assembly place.
So,
Gross Rosen. So, you know, that much freer was, and, but it was 1944. Russians already pushed away, Americans already invaded on the other side, so they have to give more freedom. But there was much more freedom, and food didn't improve very much because simple reason, they didn't have it very much themselves. So.
Did the civilians try to help you at all? Did they trade goods for things?
It's just to say that we have almost everything what we wanted for the soccer teams. From the civilians, from outside civilians. But that was strictly under cover. The SS didn't know that. They knew it, but they didn't do much about it because they knew the war was almost over, so they didn't. They even played soccer with us. That just to make the story funny, the incident funny, that one time the Polish team played against German teams, and one of the top enlisted SS men decided he wants to play for the Polish team. So we say, okay, you can play for us. And then the commandant, SS commandant, he was like a captain. He decided to want to play for the German team. So he went in the field. I think they were a little bit tipsy.
How did you feel about that?
And the funny part of it, we said, just let them play. They play almost by themselves. We just run around them. But that was one of this incident which stuck so funny in it. But that's happened. So, but it was 1944. So it's things came to a close.
So, what you're saying then that the closer the end of the war came, pressure was let up rather than becoming more cruel. Or...
In our camp, pressure you did feel the pressure let up.
There were weddings and even maternity wards for pregnant women. Inmates were falling in love and getting married in the camps. Over 3,000 live births were registered in Auschwitz alone, with not a single infant death while it was in operation under German rule. The evil Nazis even set up a nursery for the children.
Freddy Hirsch called me to the children's barracks he was heading then, and he asked me if I could paint something on the wall for the children, and I said, well, if you can get the materials, he said, I'll get the materials. I said, okay. And then a very handsome young blonde man from the men's camp came over one day, and Freddy Hirsch called me to come and meet him. And he asked me what I need. So I said, well, if I can get any wall paints, so any tempera paints, I would like those if you can get me some. And he said, yes, anything you want. And so before I knew it, Freddie had the stuff ready for me, and I started painting. At first, not knowing what, I looked at that huge drab, it was kind of olive colored, like all the barracks were, wall. And I thought, well, the thing to do is to make it look like we are in a Swiss chalet on the deck, and there is a balustrade with flowers on, flower pots on it, and we are looking out at the beautiful meadows and maybe see some cows and sheep and stuff. And I started painting. And then afterwards, far in the distance, I was putting some sheep and some cows. And then I noticed that all the kids were standing around me, behind me. So I turned around and I asked them if they would, do they have any special wish what to put in that meadow? And they said, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And that was a very surprising answer. So I made a painting of Dopey standing on another dwarf's head with a cloak around him, so he looked like a tall guy, so he would be as tall as Snow White. And they were dancing together, and the shoes, those soft shoes and everything. And the kids loved it, and I made some other dwarfs around, one who was playing the accordion. I think that was Grumpy, the mean one, and the professor with the glasses. I made almost all the dwarfs standing around. Some of them were clapping, and that's what the kids liked. I now understand that there was another painter who continued something, painting on the walls after I have left. I don't know about that.
When you were in the process of doing that, what did it do not only for you, but for the children? On an emotional level.
Well, it did several things, not just emotional, but the children then wrote a play which was a satire of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. So I figured out a way of making a crown out of paper, and the kids were painting it gold and putting like jewels on it. And then I took some paper strips and I painted them with a black paint. And I don't know about the costumes, what they made costumes out of, but the play was very successful because the little girl who was playing Snow White had an incredible voice, a gorgeous soprano, just like the one that you hear in the movie.
How were they allowed to put on a play in Auschwitz?
I don't know, but it was done kind of quite hush-hush, all of it, except that when it was put on, suddenly some SS men appeared, and they watched. And then when Arno Böhm put on that play, he wanted something like a vaudeville play, which I was in too. That was when I couldn't stand the breath of the guy who was playing with me.
The building just left entering Auschwitz was actually a brothel used by the internees of the camp. Hospitals and camp dental facilities attended by camp inmates, dentists, and nurses to deal with the inmates' dental problems. The Auschwitz camp had sick bays and hospitals where thousands of inmates were cured. The camp authorities, foremost the garrison physician, Dr. Wirths, tried all imaginable ways to keep the Auschwitz inmates alive, strong, and healthy. The Holocaust is the only claimed genocide which is sold by people who by their own accounts were treated in hospitals in the so-called extermination camps. The inmates also built an elegant Olympic-sized swimming pool, complete with several diving boards, where they would sunbathe while watching the water polo matches on Saturday and Sunday afternoons. According to official figures, there were 523,000 Jews in Germany in January 1933. The Kocher report reveals that as of December 1942, there were only 9,127 Jews in all the concentration camps. Officials from the International Red Cross visited the camps regularly and had complete access to the camps, documented everything, and estimated the total dead from all the camps to be around 271,000 to 290,000. About half of these dead were Jewish. So we are now talking about some 150 to 200,000 Jews that died in the German camps, primarily of disease. In the 1,650-page Red Cross report, there was never a mention of any gas chambers. There basically were four categories interned during the war: Poles, Jews, Russians, and political prisoners, sometimes alluded to as Germans. Jews made up less than 40% of Auschwitz, only around 12% of Dachau, and only around 30% of Buchenwald.
You've got, for example, the death books of Auschwitz, which are the most reliable source. The Soviets confiscated all the information about lives and death of people living in Auschwitz when they liberated the camp, and those were finally published in the 1990s, and those give you a total, what is it, 29,000 Jews die in Auschwitz throughout the World War II, okay? And you've got somewhat more Catholics die. You've got more Catholics than Jews dying at Auschwitz. And if you want to say, oh, there's some missing data there, some Jews not registered who died, and so on, well, you can point it out. At the very most, I would say 40,000 Jews dying at Auschwitz. Now, I don't allow it to go any higher than that. And that is 100 times less than the 4 million plaque at Birkenau. After the war, Soviets put that totally absurd figure.
Number of dead at Auschwitz was revised in 1989 from 4.1 million down to 1 million. Upon capture by the Soviet Union, original propaganda also claimed that 2 million were murdered in Majdanek, which included 7 homicidal gas chambers. 5 of these 7 have been admitted to never even have served as homicidal gas chambers. Number of dead at Majdanek was revised in 2005 from 2 million to 78,000. But somehow, the official account of 6 million dead remained unchanged. So, what is 6 million minus 4 million minus 2 million? The Holocaust is the only claimed genocide where millions can be reduced from the total claim to be killed, but the total figure always remains 6 million. The British Secret Service had cracked the German top secret Enigma code and had access to most German military communications by 1942, and there were no references in the decrypts to gassings.
Well, it's the most reliable, authoritative source you could possibly have, because Britain was overhearing the German radio messages when the Germans didn't know they were being intercepted. And by the Enigma code breakers got these messages, and after 50 years, they've finally been released in the National Archives. In the mid-90s, they were put out. A historian takes no interest in these decrypts for the obvious reason that they show no sign of any Holocaust going on, OK? They show different ethnic groups being moved around, different labour camps, for example, Jews coming to Auschwitz and Jews leaving Auschwitz. The four main categories, Poles, Russians, Jews, German political prisoners, that they group the inmates as, and they show the great endeavour to get useful industrial work out of the inmates. They discuss the different kinds of work they're trying to do and what resources they need, ordering stuff so it can be done, and then they describe the shattering impact of typhus epidemic breaking out, especially at Auschwitz in the middle of 42, and the struggle to be able to cope with it and get it under control, and the sense of horror as the whole of Auschwitz camp was quarantined as the epidemics took their toll. The decrypts show that the only thing people were... basically, they were killed if they tried to escape. There were guards who would shoot anyone tried to escape. But otherwise, you know, there are rules for treating inmates properly. And the SS guards had to treat them properly and could be court-martialed if they didn't. Inmate could put in a complaint if they weren't treated properly.
Letters recently found in the US archives prove that US and German top-level government officials talked with each other through Swiss and Irish consuls in 1944 to 1945 about the conditions of inmates in German-operated camps. Germany guaranteed to evacuate inmates to save them from the Soviets, and former camp inmates confirmed inmates were being safely evacuated. The Allies confirmed the Germans were helping the inmates, not murdering them.
Several sources, including the World Almanac, Red Cross documentation, the New York Times, and the Chambers Encyclopedia, shows that the Jewish population recorded does not reflect the testimonials given on the Holocaust. The Jewish World Almanac has been regarded as the absolute most authentic and trustworthy source for the world's Jewish population numbers. And according to the World Almanac, the world population of Jews increased between 1933 and 1948 from 15,315,000 to 15,753,000. The Nuremberg trials were held in the German city of Nuremberg from 1945 to 1949. The National Socialist leaders were arrested and placed on trial for alleged war crimes. In the courtroom was four judges, one each from the US, Britain, France, and the Soviet Union. The Nuremberg prosecutors, Kepner, Rapp, Niedermann, all were Jews. In a letter to his wife, Nuremberg chief prosecutor Thomas J. Dodd wrote that the prosecution team was 75% Jewish. The general prosecutor for the High Court was Dr. Jacob Meissner, a Jew. According to Louis Marschalko, a wartime Hungarian journalist who wrote about the trials, out of 3,000 people employed on the staff at the Nuremberg courts, 2,400 were Jews. The Holocaust narrative is used to take away focus from the war crimes committed by Stalin, Roosevelt, Churchill, the Red Army, Eisenhower, and Allied forces, and instead scapegoats the National Socialists for most of the war's horrors. At the Nuremberg trials, the existence of gas chambers was not established by physical and technical evidence that is normally required in any criminal trial. Article 19 and 21 of the Statute of the Court dispense the charge of this constraint. The alleged gas chambers were neither studied nor described. American revisionist Samuel Crowell, in his brilliant 2011 book, The Gas Chamber of Sherlock Holmes, writes how the Allies presented just four German documents at the Nuremberg trials to prove that the Nazis gassed people, and all of these documents were mistranslated or completely taken out of context. The National Socialists at the war crimes trials were tortured by the mostly Jewish, communist, and British interrogators, usually by having their testicles crushed until they would admit the Holocaust. Jewish-led prosecutor in the Einsatzgruppen trials publicly admitted to having witnessed torture and personally used death threats to extract confessions. Simpson Army Commission judge said the investigators would put a black hood over the accused head and then punch him in the face with brass knuckles, kick him and beat him with rubber hoses. All but two of the Germans in the 139 cases we investigated had been kicked in the testicles beyond repair. Rudolf Höss was one of them. He was arrested and tortured and bullied into unrealistic and absurd confessions. The wrong answer would give him terrible punishments. The gassing methods that he confessed to was totally implacable. Confessions were based on torture where Höss had been broken down to the point that he could say anything to avoid having more of the treatment. Höss was later hanged so that nobody would find out the truth. Höss lied to save the lives of his wife and children. All of this had been confirmed in a book published in 1983 titled Legions of Death, which contains the recollection of British Jewish sergeant Bernard Clark, who brags about how he tortured Höss and threatened his family to force a confession out of him. Clark even threatened to send Höss' children to the gulags in Siberia if he did not confess. The Jewish domination and control of the trials was obvious. Even the hangman for the 10 National Socialist leaders sentenced to death, Master Sergeant John C. Woods, was a Jew. And the hangings took place on the October 16, 1946, the Jewish holiday of Purim. In the Book of Esther, the 10 sons of Haman, an enemy of the Jews, were hanged on Purim Day. The executioners used a short drop instead of a neck-breaking long drop. The victims thus died a longer death due to strangulation. The trapdoor was too small, such that the several of the men suffered bleeding head injuries When they hit the sides of the trapdoor while falling, the bodies were cremated and scattered over a river, denying the families the right of burial as a final insult. The Soviet propagandists, Ilya Ehrenberg, yes, you know the Jew who encouraged the genocide and mass rape of the German women, he knew about a 6 million already in November 1944. As English newspapers were announcing that Ehrenberg was going to publish a book on claimed German atrocities, he described how 6 million Jews had been massacred by the Germans. Considering how it takes months to write a book, the 6 million figure must have been around well before November 1944. As the Allies were about to invade Germany, Ilya Ehrenberg wrote the following in the newspaper Soviet War News published by the Soviet Embassy in London. In regions they seized, the Germans they killed all the Jews, from the old folks to infants in arms. Ask any German prisoner why his fellow countrymen annihilated 6 million innocent people. And he will reply quite simply, why? Because they were Jews. The claim was repeated in the same newspaper in January 4th, 1945, and again on March 15th, 1945. But how could Ehrenberg know that 6 million Jews had been killed before even a single Allied soldier had set foot on German soil? On April 30th, 1945, when Hitler died and Germany surrendered, the New York Times reported that more than 6 million inmates had been liberated, not killed, in German concentration camps. In June 1945, before the Nuremberg trials began, the man who was organizing it, U.S. Chief Prosecutor Robert Jackson, met three lawyers representing major influential Jewish organizations to get their input for the upcoming trial. Regarding Jewish population losses, Jackson asked them straightforward, how great were those Jewish losses? One of the Jewish lawyers responded spontaneously, 6 million. But how could he have known this? The truth is that the 6 million figure is a symbolic religious mantra that has been repeated over 200 times in Jewish-owned media throughout the last century, and long before Hitler even was born, and long before National Socialism even existed.
After the war, Soviets put that totally absurd figure. That 6 million figure was basically a mantra that had been throbbing through the 20th century, right from the end of the 19th century when it began. The 6 million figure began as a newspaper, as a fundraising appeal. American Jews were fundraising on the grounds that 6 million European Jews were in trouble, right? And it started off Jews in Russia. 6 million Jews in Russia are in trouble, so on, so on, so on. And then in the 1930s, it became 6 million Jews in Europe under threat because of Hitler, and so on. And then finally at Nuremberg, it became in the past tense, 6 million Jews have been killed. And you've got something like 200 newspaper headlines of that. It's extraordinary the way that mantric number, which never in any sense at any point counted, okay? It's important to appreciate that nobody counted 6 million or in any way looked as if they had counted 6 million at the Nuremberg trial after the war, right? It was just that figure that had been passing as a mantra through newspaper headlines, 6 million Jews in Europe.
In this book, The First Holocaust, The Surprising Origin of the 6 Million Figure, Don Hedesheimer illustrates that the 6 Million figure actually dates back to Jewish fundraising campaigns that started in the end of 19th century and reached its peak in the mid-1920s. During almost 100 years, Jews spread a rumor that 6 millions of Jews in Europe were suffering, and sometimes going so far as that 6 million Jews had died already. The Jewish-owned New York Times was the main vehicle for the propaganda, which even include well-known buzzwords like extermination and Holocaust. After the Zionist Balfour Declaration was signed, the Jews claimed that 6 million Jews in Europe were under threat from extermination unless they got a homeland in Palestine. This was 14 years before the National Socialists came to power, and 24 years before the alleged Holocaust started. The origin of this figure of 6 million is not based on any kind of factual knowledge regarding Jewish population losses. It is purely a fictional, symbolic, esoteric, and mystical number. Written in the Jewish Torah was a prophecy that the Jews would be allowed to return to Israel minus 6 million of their people. You shall return minus 6 million. The book The Holocaust, Dogma of Judaism, describes how the 6 million number is Kabbalistically derived. The number 6 million is a symbolic number with a religious meaning, and the Holocaust is part of the religious dogma of Judaism. Benjamin Blech confirmed this reality in his own book, The Secrets of Hebrew Words. The actual Holocaust stories comes from two sources: the captured high officials of the National Socialist Party that were coerced and tortured during the Nuremberg trials, and the actual Jewish survivors that came out of those concentration camps. These Jewish testaments range from gassings, Jew-eating bears and eagles in cages, vaporizing 20,000 Jews near Auschwitz with atomic energy, torturing and killing Jewish prisoners to the tempo of a specially composed tango of death, steaming Jews to death like lobsters at Treblinka, electrocuting them to death, musical camp dogs ripping Jews who played false in the orchestras to death, homosexuals being tickled to death, geysers of Jewish blood, Jews being made into lampshades and soap, carts on rails that threw Jews into the ovens directly, Nazi masturbation machines, and yeah, additional testaments that were given are just as ludicrous.
One thing that I'll never forget that I heard, and he said, the Nazis are taking our young Jewish infants and they're tearing them in half by their legs, and they're throwing them in the Dniester. The Dniester is a river. So they said, for every person that's going to take their lives, they're going to torture to death 5 of us. Then they punished us. For every man that ran through the wire, they took 100 inmates, and they killed them in front of everybody.
The greatest love story we've ever told on this show.
Herman Rosenblatt received international attention for his story about being a hungry little boy in a Nazi concentration camp who was thrown apples every day by a little girl on the other side of the fence. Years later, according to the story, Rosenblatt met that same girl on a blind date in New York City, and he proposed on the spot.
I used to come by every day, bring the apple, have in my jacket, and a piece of bread, and he used to say, I'll see you tomorrow.
The story landed Herman and Roma Rosenblatt on Oprah twice and in newspapers all over the world. They also got a book and movie deal. But the story wasn't true.
Why did you do it. Why did you tell such a big lie to so many people for so long?
It wasn't a lie. It was my imagination. And in my imagination, in my mind, I believed it. Even now I believe it, that she was there and she threw the apple to me.
How can you say it wasn't a lie? It wasn't true, and you know it's not true.
Yes, it's not true. But in my imagination, it was true.
Members of his own family say his real motivation was money. Herman and Roma Rosenblatt told their false story publicly for more than a decade, but it all fell apart about 6 weeks ago after Holocaust scholars proved that it was physically impossible for prisoners to approach the fence at the concentration camp where Herman was kept, and that Roma's family was actually more than 200 miles away at the time. Rosenblatt is remarkably unrepentant about his years of lying.
I pronounce my love for you forever.
When you look at that, does it make you uncomfortable at all?
No.
You think that was the right thing to do?
Yeah.
And while you were up on the stage there with all those people, in the back of your mind, were you not thinking,
no,
I'm not telling the truth here?
No.
So if you had to do it over again, would you tell the same story?
Yeah.
You would?
Yes.
I simply don't know what to say. I mean, it's his imagination, but he knows it's not true.
He made up a fantasy world, and he was living in that fantasy world.
And his son says, tried to stop him.
Yes.
Good heavens. Okay, thank you, Dan.
Pleasure.
Meet Dick Groscher tours Sweden talking to children, telling them of the horrors of the German concentration camps. It turned out that his story was directly plagiarized from a fictional book called Mila 18 from 1961. Joseph Hurt from Pennsylvania gave public speeches for years where he claimed to have escaped from Auschwitz and even met evil Nazi doctor Josef Mengele. He had now confessed that he had fabricated the entire story. He admitted that everything was a lie. Hurt had even tattooed a fake prison number on his arm to make people believe in his lies. Otto Utkinant had for years been paid shekels to lecture in German schools about his experiences of the Holocaust. He has talked about the Kristallnacht, how he lost 72 relatives, including mother, father, and sister, and how he himself was interned at Buchenwald. However, Otto now admits that the whole story was a lie. Misha de Fonseca wrote a best-selling memoir about her experience of the Holocaust. Her story was published almost 20 years ago as Misha, a Memoir of the Holocaust Years. The book describes how, when she was six, her Jewish parents were taken from their home by the Nazis, and how she set off across Belgium and Germany and Poland to find them on foot, living off stolen scraps of food, until she was adopted by a pack of wolves. She also claimed to have shot a Nazi soldier in self-defense. The story became a huge bestseller and was even made into a film in France. But in 2008, it was found to be fabricated, and everything was a lie. The author, whose real name was found to be Monique de Weil, said that it is not the true reality, but it's my reality. There are times when I find it difficult to differentiate between reality and my inner world. Misha will now have to pay back the money she was awarded, which amounts to $22.5 million. Elie Wiesel has told us for 50 years that while at Auschwitz he was tattooed on his left arm the number A7713. He also adds that his father was given the number A7712. But a real Auschwitz survivor, Miklos Gruner, claims that Elie Wiesel is an imposter. Miklos, who actually was at the camp, claims that Elie Wiesel stole the identity of a real man named Lazar Wiesel, who the number A7713 actually belonged to. First of all, if you look at his arms, Elie Wiesel does not have a tattoo. The number A7712 actually was given to a man named Abraham Wiesel, Lazar's older brother. Elie Wiesel never claimed that he saw any homicidal gas chambers. Instead, he claims that he witnessed evil Germans throwing Jewish babies in gigantic flames leaping up from a ditch. But this has also been debunked by scientists, historians, and engineers. Auschwitz was built on a swamp with a high water table, which made it impossible for bodies to have been burned in ditches. Not to mention that it was impossible for human bodies to be totally consumed by flames in this manner because of lack of oxygen. Miklos, however, says that he never saw any ditches where children were burning. Elie Wiesel explains that some events do take place, but are not true. Others are, although they never occurred. In 1986, Miklos Gruner met Elie Wiesel in Stockholm. Miklos thought that he was going to meet Lazar Wiesel. But after the meeting, Miklos said, "I was stunned to see a man I did not recognize at all. He was not my fellow prisoner." Miklos also was surprised that Elie couldn't speak Hungarian, but spoke English with a strong French accent, even though Wiesel claims that he was born in Hungary. Neither Elie Wiesel nor his father, Shlomo Wiesel, are named in any records from Auschwitz or Buchenwald. After the war, Elie Wiesel joined the Jewish terrorist group Irgun. Anyway, Elie Wiesel is today laughing all the way to the bank as his best-selling book, Night, brought him international recognition and millions of dollars. He even won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1986. Out of thousands of real Jewish survivors from the German camps, the international Jewish community handpicked Zionist and hate-filled liars to spread anti-German propaganda. But of course, not all Jews are lying. Many Jews don't agree with the Holocaust narrative. Many of them testified that they never saw any mass murders or gassings. But these Jews have effectively been silenced by anti-free speech Zionist organizations to cover up the truth. Paul Resinier was arrested by the Gestapo in October 1943 and deported to Germany, where he was held prisoner until the end of the war in Buchenwald and Dora concentration camps. Resinier was upset by the many lies and myths about the concentration camps that were being circulated. French resistance members, who also were interned in various German concentration camps during the war, including Auschwitz and other alleged death camps, they all gave accounts of their treatment by the Germans, and they all denied any knowledge of gas chambers and a mass murder program in the camps. Resinier said that never at any moment did the responsible authorities of the Third Reich intend to order or in fact order the extermination of the Jews in this or any other manner. Maria von Herwarden testified about her camp experience in a Toronto district court in March 1988. She testified that she witnessed the deaths of many fellow inmates by disease and particularly typhus, and she saw some take their own lives, but she saw no evidence at all of mass killings, gassings, or of any extermination program. The Jew Benedikt Kautschke, who spent the years from 1938 to 1945 in concentration camps, three of these in Auschwitz, said, "I was in the big concentration camps in Germany. I must truthfully state that in no camp have I ever seen anything that might have resembled gas chambers." A Jewish woman named Marika Frank arrived at Auschwitz-Birkenau from Hungary in July 1944, when 25,000 Jews were supposedly gassed and cremated daily, according to the official story. She testified after the war that she heard and saw nothing of gas chambers during the time she was interned there. Jewish writer Gerhard Menunin says, "The Holocaust is the biggest lie in history. Germany has no blame for the Second World War. That Jewish pressure has inflicted laws on democratic societies to prevent questions and incessant promotion and indoctrination of the same advertently incontestable Holocaust proves it must be a lie. Why else would no one be allowed to question it?" Jewish professor Norman Finkelstein says, "The Holocaust proved to be the perfect weapon for deflecting criticism of Israel. The Holocaust may yet turn out to be the greatest robbery in the history of mankind." Jewish chief rabbi Aryeh Friedman says, "The Holocaust is a successful historical fiction." Jewish professor Roger DeMargo said,
"I know that the plot, for instance, of the Holocaust is a complete fake, because it's very easy to know, because it's a simple technical arithmetic problem which could be solved by a child in high school. Now, any chemist knows that you can't gas people with cyanide acid, It's called like that in English. Hydrogenic?
Hydrocyanic acid.
Hydrocyanic acid. 1,000 or 2,000 people at a time. It's well known. And even the most important American Jewish newspapers, like the American Jewish Yearbook, said that there was 3,000,000 Jews in occupied Europe in 1942. So I don't see how they could have killed 6 million Jews when there was only 3 million. So I think anybody can see that. I enlisted in 1944.
I
enlisted for 3 years in 1944. It was in the war. The war finished in 1945. But I was in the army in 1944 because, of course, as everybody did, I believed that Hitler was the real monster that everybody said he was. Since I have studied what happened in Nazism, under Nazism, what Hitler did want to do and say, when you read these books, anybody can read Mein Kampf, or can read The Myth of the 20th Century by Rosenberg, and anybody can know also what happened these last 50 years when Hitler had absolutely nothing to do and not the slightest influence, because Nazi has been dead now for 50 years. So you can do what happened. And what happens, I told you in my lecture, is absolutely incredible. And at the top of everything, you can see the Jews. I told you, I studied the books which really express Nazism, that is to say, Mein Kampf and the Myth of the 20th Century by Rosenberg. I studied what happened during the war, and especially what Hitler actually did, which is hidden, which is concealed to us, what he did in Germany. And the only thing we know about Hitler is that he killed 6 million Jews who never existed in gas chambers which nobody ever saw. That's the only thing which people know about Hitler. But when you really know what he did, what he actually did in Germany, well, when you have studied all that, you see that you have been completely misled, to use a mild term.
Stephen F. Pinter, who served as a lawyer for the United States War Department and the occupation forces in Germany and Austria for 6 years after the war, made the following statement. I was in Dachau for 17 months after the war as a U.S. Department attorney, and can state that there was no gas chamber in Dachau, nor was there a gas chamber at any of the other concentration camps in Germany.
I challenge your history again. There is absolutely no record that 6 million people were put in concentration camps. They only have 16 million to begin with.
But in spite of Jewish opposition to historical integrity, Holocaust revisionists are breaking the bars erected around their imprisonment of conscience and speaking out. Robert Faurisson, for instance, a recognized French specialist in document analysis, has stated that no document has been found that proves that a plan for Jewish extermination by the Third Reich was ever contemplated. Expulsion, yes, but extermination, no. As punishment for challenging the official Holocaust line, Faurisson has been repeatedly the victim of physical assault, countless legal actions, freezings of his bank account, and heavy fines. In the year 2000, Swiss scholar Jürgen Groff, author of the book The Holocaust Swindle, after receiving a 2-year jail sentence for allegedly questioning the existence of gas chambers in Auschwitz, fled to St. Petersburg, where he's been living ever since as an exile. There in St. Petersburg, Groff is engaged in examining Soviet archives, which Groff claims, when allowed for release, will bring Jewry's official version of the Holocaust to its knees. Particularly scandalous and a blow to free speech and historical inquiry is the arrest of German lawyer Horst Mahler. In 2009, Mahler was sentenced by two German courts to 11 years in prison total for opinion crimes, one of them being Mahler's assertion that the official version of the Holocaust is the greatest lie ever perpetrated in human history.
The benefits of exaggerating the Holocaust have been enormous to Zionist Jews, both financially and politically. The Holocaust is today used as a guilt weapon,
shame,
as many racial groups,
shame,
exploit the empathy that white,
shame,
Europeans are known to have in order to guilt trip,
shame,
them into a collective guilt,
shame,
by making whites feel shameful,
shame,
and guilty about their past.
Give them the guilt trip.
That's absolutely.
We need to play on that guilt.
I bring up everything from the past. 50 years.
If the left, communists, or Jews hear a person discussing anything related to immigration, demographics, or race realism, they immediately label that person as a neo-Nazi, the next Hitler, or anti-Semitic. This is done to shut down the conversation and to make the person look like a hateful bigot.
Really quite dangerous, racist, fascist rhetoric. People don't think that it's okay to be a fucking Nazi anymore.
It's basically the same as quoting Hitler.
There's a bunch of opportunistic, hate-mongering fascists trying to garner sympathy with garbage propaganda videos.
I directly compared everyone who talked about cultural Marxists to the fascist literal Nazis who invented the term.
Racism is especially sensitive against individuals who were murdered in the millions.
Very racist and anti-Semitic things. This is kind of embarrassing, but this hits somewhat close to home since some of my family aligns with that way of thinking. They don't think that it happened. Just gonna erase all that history. It sounds like my grandpa or any other racist person all blame the Jews. This is literally my grandpa.
Of course, she doesn't even believe that the Holocaust even fucking happened. Well, I mean, he did kill like 6 million fucking Jews. I mean, believe it or not, he also killed 6 million fucking Jews. Listen, you fucking cow, okay? When you kill 6 million Jews, it doesn't matter what you did in the past.
Holocaust?
Holocaust, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to talk to Mercedes Carrera about the Holocaust.
6 million.
When I was a punk rocker... When I was a punk rocker, by the way...
There's 6 million! There were 6 million of them! It was 6 million!
The Holocaust narrative is used to strengthen Jewish identity simultaneously as undermining, demonizing, and delegitimizing white European identity. It is used as a manipulative weapon against all white Europeans.
I have done my research.
You're fucking you're fucking white male! Yes!
In America.
Yes, look at all the fucking black people that are Mexicans. It's not a fucking issue compared to the black people that are police.
Bullshit! The white guys are racist!
Shame. Now, you owe me some money. Okay, you owe me reparations. Why is that?
Because every freedom that I have and have taken for granted for my entire life has been made possible by wealth that my ancestors stole.
Uh-huh. Good.
The Holocaust narrative is primarily used to discourage policies such as nationalism and instead promote globalism and multiculturalism in the Western world. Europeans are constantly reminded of never forget, never again, and that the horrors will never be repeated. This is done to brainwash the Europeans to not stand up for their own nation and race. Through this narrative, the Europeans support the politics that protect the rights of minority groups instead of their own people. Any criticism against the Jews or the Jewish state of Israel had practically been outlawed. The Jewish Holocaust turned into a religion in which no deviation from the orthodoxy is acceptable. Even if there have been many Holocausts and greater genocides throughout history, the Jewish Holocaust is the only one that counts, and it is of course the only one of whose orthodoxy is criminalized to even question. In fact, it is the only historical event that is prohibited by law to even question in many countries. The reason why you probably never even have heard about this research that have proven the official story to be false is because researchers who have dared to explore the many inconsistencies and contradictions of the Holocaust story have been subjected to physical attacks, including harassment, vandalism, career destruction, drive-by shootings, physical assaults, and even firebombings of the warehouse that holds their work. Jewish and Zionist anti-free speech organizations are doing everything they can to suppress the truth through censoring the internet and burning the books that expose their lies. Thanks to the pressure from anti-free speech organizations, Facebook, YouTube, and other social media are doing their best to repress and silence the truth, and we cannot even rely on these platforms to be used in the future. Wikipedia and Google is both monitored to fit the politically correct narrative to mislead the population.
Moetzet Yesh, in conjunction with My Israel, has arranged an instruction day for wiki editors. The goal of the day is to teach people how to edit in Wikipedia, which is the number one source of information today in the world. As a way of example, if someone searches the Gaza flotilla, we want to be there. We want to be the guys who influence what is written there, how it's written, and to ensure that it's balanced and Zionist in nature.
I came here to learn more about how we as Israelis and as Jews can defend Israel online, on the internet, and particularly in Wikipedia in this case. Wikipedia is a bit of a complex system, and it's sometimes hard to figure out the rules. I've personally tried to edit things in Wikipedia that were against Israel. Knowledge is important for anyone who wants to be active in defending Israel on the internet, so that we can go and we can see the information and we can say this isn't quite right, it's showing one side of the story, and I have the power and the right to change that. And in general, it's so important for us to be online working to defend ourselves and to prove to the world and to ourselves that we are just and we are right. And because right now, if you look online, if you do searches for certain terms related to Israel, it's just filled with anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, and garbage. And there's not enough of us out there working to counteract that and make sure that the other side of the story, our side of the story, and our right side of the story is getting the right coverage and the coverage that it needs. So,
in our supposedly free and democratic countries that frequently pride themselves on being tolerant, third world invaders are now raping European women and receive the most lenient sentences. Meanwhile, Holocaust deniers or anti-Semites can get many years in prison for merely questioning a historical event. It is clear that our governments are not working for our people anymore. According to Gerard Menunin, there were 117,344 accusations of thought crimes in the German courts in the year 1994 to 2004. Around 2,000 people are put on trial every year for Holocaust denial, which can give up to 5 years in prison and a fine.
Most of the people in England, America, Australia have no idea what a tyranny this country is.
Hundreds. We have more than 2,000 process, more than 2,000 trials a year, and that over more than 10 years. So you can imagine how many people have suffered from it, and families have been destroyed, and they lost their job, and so on and so on. That they said the truth.
And simply for inquiring into the sources for it. They are not promoting any ideas. They are simply asking the questions like you do.
Yes, and now what happened in Paris is just for us, because all the heads of the nation said press free and meaning freedom is the greatest thing for democracy, and therefore I say I use this freedom.
The Holocaust is a story that the globalists don't allow to even be debated or questioned. Anyone who questions the story immediately is branded as a racist, a Nazi who wants to kill 6 million Jews, and a Holocaust denier, hater, or anti-Semite. This labeling technique is used to discourage discourse and discussions related to Holocaust and World War II. Holocaust revisionism is today considered a taboo matter, with laws and prison sentences applied to Europeans who question the politically correct Holocaust narrative. This is a gross infringement on Article 19 in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. Everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media and regardless of frontiers. The mere fact that Holocaust denial laws in Europe exist should raise an eyebrow. Truth does not fear investigation. You certainly do not need to make up laws to protect history unless you are trying to protect a lie. The truth stands on its own legs.
time, my whole family's wiped out.
Yes, sir. Yes,
yes. The Holocaust is big business because Germany so far has given the Jews, I think, at least $200 billion. So it's big business. And some of you are still getting $1,000 a month. And a lot of people don't know this. And then people don't realize who brought the slaves to America. They were Jewish ships.
Let's take a break, because the issue that we're talking about today is whether or not there's a Holocaust. We'll talk about slavery, who brought them here, later. We'll be back after this.